Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Veritas Forum. We've got an absolutely fascinating topic to look at tonight. So we're looking at genes, atoms, and human identity. So I think I need to make a disclaimer as I start off. I am neither a geneticist nor a chemist. I'm a social scientist. So I know absolutely nothing about the topic tonight. So there are no stupid questions at all. So before, as I was preparing to moderate this talk as a social scientist, I did a lot of background reading on the Human Genome Project, which I believe Praveen has actually worked on. And I became convinced that this was probably the most significant scientific breakthrough of our era. And coming from a public health perspective, I also learned that there's some 1,800 human disease genes that they've uncovered, and just the potential of the Human Genome Project to change our lives and to change our future, biological futures, is just unbounded. But what fascinated me even more than the public health aspects was the fact that I learned that 99.9% of all the genes that have been uncovered are common to us all, and only 0.01% of our genes actually determine the diversity between us. And in fact, there's more diversity within races than there is between races. And this is just a sort of fascinating topic. But as I went further and I was preparing even further, I started to get the feeling we're opening a Pandora's box, and that we're expecting in further investigations into our human genome to maybe uncover more than there's the potential to do, more than what we're asking it to do, and that is tell us about our ancestry, where we came from, tell us a little bit about who we are right now, and then any biological events that are going to be shaping our lives in the future. So a couple of really important questions I'd like the presenters to sort of talk about tonight that sort of came up in my research. And these are the sort of three governing questions. Is genetics a valid basis on which anyone can base their understanding of who we are and what we are? Can people choose their identity? And if so, how much can we choose given that we've got 99% of all our genes in common? And how much of identity is non-changeable, and how much of that, in other words, given to us, and how can we shape our identities as human beings? Are there choices that we can make in this regard? So I'm hoping that's going to sort of bring our discussion together. Prior to the forum, I asked both Roald and Praveen to present some opening statements, and I asked them to include in those statements some sort of background on their cultural, racial, and ethnic, and also their faith backgrounds. And knowing that both Roald and Praveen currently have faith perspectives that are different from their families of origins and their community of origins, to talk maybe a little bit about that transition of how their identity changed once they changed their faith beliefs. So I'm going to ask Roald to start off with some brief remarks, and then Praveen, you can sit.
Shall I sit?
Yes.
Can
yes.
I sit?
Yes. Yes.
So first of all, that would take more than 5 minutes to say what we need to say, but let me try. So I come from a Jewish family, born in Poland just before World War II. The war, the Holocaust, shaped part of my response to Judaism. And it's quite natural to see all that horror result in some emotionally wrenching changes. I never was an observant Jew. The reason was that my parents were socialists. So this is a thread of Jewish assimilation that anyway pointed away from religion. Even my name, Roald, I was named after Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian explorer who first reached the South Pole just 103 years ago. Even that name is a reflection of the structuring of Jewish identity in assimilationist times in Poland. My uncles were named Samuel and Abraham. There was no way that my parents were going to name me Samuel and Abraham. Neither were they going to give me the name of a Polish saint, or a Catholic saint, rather. Michael or Thomas were out too. So one looked for the names of secular heroes. That was part of the culture that I came from, and the name of a polar explorer was just fine for structuring that identity. So a little bit about where I came from. I did later in life acquire objections to the tradition of Judaism from which I came and which shaped my people, and they most certainly were and are my people over 2,000 years, and of course were very important to the development of Christianity. Let me tell you a little bit about what my objections were to my own tradition, which I didn't share already, but they were later and they were recent. And some of them are fairly obvious. One is, for instance, the description in the Bible, if taken literally, and here I mean the Torah, the five books of Moses, and the subsequent writings, especially in the subsequent writings, there were acts which violated my contemporary 20th century morality, the extermination of cities down to the last inhabitant. We know those passages in Kings where, for instance, where that is described. And that is obviously abhorrent to a modern sensibility. A second thing is there were rules and taboos that did not seem realistic. You know what I'm talking about, whether some food is kosher. There were even much more esoteric ideas about not mixing linen and wool in your clothing, which you probably haven't heard about. But these things which make anthropological sense, which I could tell you about, did not make sense to an aspiring scientist. Why should it matter to God that we mix linen and wool together in our clothing? A third thing was that there was an obvious inability to adjust to modern times. Now, this was weird because there was some ability. So slavery, which is talked about positively in some ways within the Old Testament, went out of Judaism. Of course, it had to. And so did polygamy, or rather, polygyny. That was no longer, even though that was also among the patriarchs allowed. So there was some adjustment, but there were these religious people who were still telling me that I couldn't listen to a woman singing in public. And that is one of the kind of esoteric rules of... So Barbara Streisand could not sing for me. Okay? So that obviously set me off in the wrong direction. Much more interesting, not interesting, but there were also psychological things. And the things that I've mentioned so far, incidentally, part of what Christianity reacted to as it split off from Judaism was some of the same things that bothered me about those esoteric rules. And to the Greek-influenced population that was at the heart of some of the initial recipients of Catholicism, the Hellenistic culture, that was strange. What bothered me also was the weird psychology as I grew more, I would say, adult or sensitive to the psychology of things. The weird psychology of a God needing continuous affirmation of his existence. I mean, that we would have to say over and over that blessed be the God, King of the universe, who has given us this. Why does he need that? That just didn't make sense. It seemed to me, from my knowledge of people, so I was building into God and what I knew of people, it seemed to me a weakness which I associated with people who were insecure, unsure of themselves, that they needed constant affirmation and constant praise, and I didn't see that. So those are some of the things that initially, honestly, were in my turning against Judaism. I will tell you later about why it's not just Judaism, but in general, the idea of a God also gives me trouble. But maybe that's enough to begin with.
Great. Thank you so much, Roald. Praveen.
Yes, thank you. I do want to thank the Veritas Forum for inviting me here today and for Cornell for hosting me and Dr. Avery for moderating the event. I do also want to say a few words about the distinguished gentleman with whom I share the stage today. It's an honor and a privilege to share the stage with you. Roald, you are a true, true treasure of Cornell. And your reputation precedes you. But in our brief interactions, what has impressed me most about Roald is his humility, his thoughtfulness, and his heart. If you haven't gotten to know Roald, I would. Thank you, Roald, for participating in today's event and for contributing your voice and your experience to today's discussion. And I do look forward to many more years of friendship with you. Both Roald and I have been asked, as you heard, to keep our opening remarks fairly brief, under 10 minutes. If you know anything about academics, it's that we like to talk. And we rarely do anything under 10 minutes. But I promised Rosemary, and I'm going to do my very best to keep this brief, so that we can get to some of the more interesting Q&A sections of today's event. So what makes us human? That's the topic for today's discussion. And at the heart of this question, I believe, is a search for identity, which is something that I think resonates with most, if not all of us. So who am I? Well, I am a Christian, a scientist with a Hindu background, an Indian ancestry, Canadian birth, and American citizenship. So it's a lot to unpack, and I'm certainly not going to accomplish that in 5 minutes. But in my opening remarks this evening, I think what I'll do is just highlight three major aspects of my identity. So the first is my name, Praveen Sethupathi, which is of Sanskrit origin, and it means skillful. The Praveen does anyway. And my family also calls me Raghu, which is after a great emperor in Hindu mythology, whose line gave rise to Rama, an incarnation of the Hindu god Vishnu. Sethupathi means Lord of the Bridge, and the bridge refers to a former chain of limestone shoals that connected the southern tip of India to the northern coast of Sri Lanka. And according to ancient Hindu epic Ramayana, the bridge was constructed by Lord Rama and his army. So, needless to say, my name is steeped in ancient Indian tradition and Hindu lore. And my name is one of the precious few elements of my day-to-day life that serves as a welcome reminder to me of where I come from. It strengthens my bonds with my Indian heritage, my family. My father, who gave me my name, grew up in a small village in South India, where he was raised with age-old traditions and cultural ideals, many of which he passed on to me and that I'm now passing on to my children today. India is an inextricable part of who I am, an inextricable part of my identity. I feel blessed to be an Indian American. And as an English-speaking Christian born and raised in North America, my name is one of the few things that highlight my Indian heritage. The second aspect of my identity that I'd like to highlight is my genetic makeup. Rosemary referenced this in the opening remarks. Our DNA holds traces of not only our recent human ancestry, but of a much longer evolutionary history. My genome contributes substantially to all sorts of traits, some rather prosaic, like my skin color or my height, other interesting ones, like my competitive drive and my need for the Buffalo Bills to win. My genome even holds clues about predispositions that I might have to various diseases. But as much as my genetics shapes my identity, advances in science have demonstrated that by no means does it seal the fate of my identity. For example, our environment heavily influences how our DNA works. So individuals with very similar or even identical DNA sequences will develop different traits and behaviors and identities as a result of how their unique life conditions have shaped how their DNA functions. And we can get into a little bit more of the science if there's interest as the evening progresses, but the key point is that our identities are influenced but not fully determined by any means by our genetics. The third and final aspect of my identity that I'll share is something that is wrapped up within the person of Christ. In my own spiritual journey during my years at Cornell, I studied many different faith traditions, including Christianity. And the hero of that story is a naked and disfigured and seemingly pathetic man on a cross. It seemed to me the antithesis of a hero at first. But what I would learn is that in the cross, Jesus was turning upside down my notions of power. You see, you and I, if you're anything like me anyway, would think about exercising power by exerting our perceived superiority or authority, often by force, on the world. But it seemed as though he was laying his life down before the world. In other words, it wasn't that he was powerless to stop what was happening to him, but it was that this is how far he would go to exercise his power to make things new. So, as a Christian, and one who claims to follow in the way of Christ, I am also called to live a life of self-sacrifice for the benefit of others. Now, let's be clear, I don't always live up to that calling, but it really does shape the way that I think about who I am. So that's a brief look at culture and genetics and faith and their contributions to my identity. Thank you again for the privilege to be a part of this event. I look forward to the discussion.
Great. Thank you both for keeping it nice and short and to the point. Very interesting. So the rest of the discussion now, we're going to have sort of two parts. The first parts are going to be pre-prepared questions that I've actually shared with the speakers. And either of them can answer them, and there might be more pertain to one or the other. And the first part of that's going to address the issue of biology and genetics. And then the second part is going to be more of the faith and the genetics and how those two interact. So the first question that I have pre-prepared is the following. Is there empirical evidence within science that tells us that we are more than our genes? And a sort of carry-on question to that is, some of the research that I've done has suggested that if our ancestors went through traumatic experiences, such as a war or a famine or the Holocaust, that our genes carry some memory trace of that energy through our genes. And so my question is that a possibility? And then second, what part do all of these memory traces and these genetic traits play in giving us freedom to determine who we are? So either of you can take that question.
Well, I think Praveen should answer it, because the immediate answer is a branch of science that in which he has pioneered. So tell us a little about it.
Sure. So the answer, we also have answers for meaning of life and things like that tonight if you're interested. So the answer, Rosemary, in brief, is yes, that is indeed very possible, and there are a lot of advancements in science in the last few decades that have brought us to the point where we actually can have a fairly robust conversation, not only about whether it can happen, but how it can happen, the mechanics of it. Let me give you a few examples. You've probably heard it said very often that we have billions to trillions of cells in our body, and that's true. But did you know, and maybe some of you do, that there are more bacterial cells in our body than human cells? 10 times as many, right? So right off the bat, there's a confusion. When we're talking about how we define our humanity, and we're referencing our biology, we have 10 times more cells that are microbes of various sorts than human cells in our body, whether it's on our skin or in the deep recesses of our gut. And so right off the bat, it tells you that, you know, we are indeed more than just the genetics in the human cells, just the DNA in the human cells. These microbial organisms influence us in very complex ways, and we are just at the tip, scratching the surface of understanding they are doing this and how effective and potent they can be. But it certainly has, these microbes have been connected to the development of a wide range of diseases such as diabetes, obesity, and a number of others. Another example is the field of epigenetics. And so epi, the prefix there means above or beyond. And so this was meant to indicate that it was the study of something beyond DNA itself. In our cells, DNA is not naked. It is wrapped up in this packaging material. And the packaging material can be modified chemically in diverse kinds of ways. There are hundreds of different kinds of chemical modifications that can be deposited on the packaging material of DNA. The different combinations of chemical modifications dictate whether or not certain portions of the DNA are actually going to be on or off. And if they're going to be on, to what extent are they going to be on? Are we going to turn on a particular nearby gene to 40 units or 80 units or 100 units? So they're, you can think about them also almost as dials or rheostats, right? And so you could have the same exact DNA sequence, but have it packaged differently. And what that is going to do is make the genome function differently, right? And so why is that critical to this discussion? Well, any number of lifestyle choices that we make can influence what chemical modifications are made to the packaging material and thereby influence how our DNA is going to function, which genes are going to get turned on and turned off, and to what extent. And so smoking, our diet, any number of our kinds of obvious lifestyle choices can influence the modifications of the packaging material of our DNA. There are also much more subtle things, conditions of life, abuse in early age, any number of other things like that, that have also been shown to be able to modify the epigenome, if you will. So these are all things that are happening to us externally, and yet controlling how our cells are interpreting the DNA information. And so when Rosemary refers to there being memory traces, this can indeed be the case because it turns out that some chemical modifications are heritable. They can be passed on from some one generation to the next in the same way that our DNA material can. The mechanisms of this are still being worked out, but that it can happen with some kinds of chemical modifications on the packaging material is now well appreciated.
It's a return of Lamarckian ideas in a way, but I sometimes wonder if things had gone another way and somehow Darwin and Wallace were not there, if Lamarckianism had been there for a longer time, would Darwinism have come in another way? It had to come in.
Right. Yeah.
So the reason I let him talk about it is because that's what he works on, is epigenetics, and it's wonderful to read about it. I think we are genetically prompted, perhaps limited somewhat, but prompted is mainly. And we are culturally conditioned. It sets in early on. Any of us who have children, or you can reflect on your childhood, the extent to which your peers had a greater influence on you than your parents. And ultimately, we are individually formed. And the choices are ours. If, as was said, if we share 99% of the genetic material, I want to expand that a little bit. We share with great apes 98% or some figure like that. And even with E. coli, we share a very substantial amount. And I don't think there is any doubt about this. These are facts which come out of DNA analysis. Does that make us like E. coli? Does it make you like me? Does it free us of choices for good and for evil? No more than the original sin prevents you from making a choice about being good and evil. Your genes are set some of the stage. But the diversity is quite remarkable, and especially when you add on top of biological evolution, cultural evolution, which moves so much more quickly and allows more diversity. What I mean is that, yes, you get tired if you hear that song for the ninth time, but you have the freedom to look for another song. And there is an incredible variety of songs out there. You can form your life, given chance and thoughtfulness about the choices that you make, you can form your life in an essential infinity of infinities way, and to make the choices that you need to make.
So, Rob, let me pick up on that and pick up definitely on this memory trace issue. And that is, you've spoken in the past about the experiences that your parents went through and you went through in the Holocaust. And you're now picking up on the social influences, advertising, TV, movies that we see that tell us not only who we are, but who we're supposed to be, right, within that culture. To what degree do you determine that we have actually got that freedom to choose? And maybe you could also talk a little bit about what impact the experiences of your parents and you and the Holocaust has determined your worldview and your way of making those choices in your life?
There are two different questions, but I think I do worry, like many people, about the choices that we make when those little cookies that you leave on your computer influence, yes, they influence what ads you get from Google on the sidebar, but we are headed toward a future which looks ominous, where a lot of the visual and textual prompts in our life around us will be provided based on some computer's evaluation of your likes and dislikes. And I do worry about that. I still think we have choices, you know? So, in our time, we were formed by what? By articles we read in the magazines, by movie, by pictures of American life generated in the movies, a convenient fiction serving somebody and ideal ones, but then they were modified by the realities of life. I think we were shaped by the cultural influences about us, and foremost among them was that great instrument of moral instruction, which is the novels, books, which I think shaped how we behave. And I worry a little about what that shaping will take place. Now, in my case, you mentioned the Holocaust, and that is one of the reasons why I lost the faith that I didn't have for it. So I didn't have it to begin with. But we are getting here immediately into one of the fundamental religious problems which every religion faces, and that is the existence of evil and how we deal with it, and how we reconcile it with an idea of a good God or a good presence, ideas in us. The Holocaust, with its great destruction of innocent lives on a measure which was just impossible to conceive, but only one of the great destructions of our times, be it the Armenian genocide or the number of people killed under Stalin's rule, for instance, in the Ukraine, where I come from, by the Golodomor, by the starvation, or in Mao's China. The number of innocent loss of life was enough, certainly, to make some people unreligious. But one person in my family became religious as a result. So it's unpredictable even what that suffering will cause. But it certainly played an important influence in my life and in many people in my family.
Can you remind me, Rosemary, of the insurance?
The same question.
Do you have another one?
Yes, I do.
Okay, please.
Maybe we'll move on.
Yeah.
So I'd like to sort of move a little bit more into the sort of science and faith area here. And sort of nexus of science and faith, as it were. So all of us, as we grow from infancy through to maturity, we sort of adopt or choose, I'm hoping we can choose, and it's not all just genetic, we choose a set of principles by which we organize our lives and we make sense of our lives and we interact with the world. And this sort of presents what is a worldview Right, the worldview that we hold. And you two hold very different worldviews in terms of, you know, is there a God? What role does that God play? And I've heard Rolf say many times before, both in Veritas forums and in person, that there's a certain amount of knowledge that we generate about our world that isn't scientifically provable in any way. So the question I want to ask now, maybe Rolf or Praveen can take this. How does the reason and logic and intellect you apply in your research and your professional life as scientists inform your understanding of who you are and sort of shape your worldview? And maybe you could also comment on any tensions that you feel in maintaining your intellectual integrity as well as your spiritual integrity.
Sure. So I can speak for the life sciences. There's a common misconception that the scientific pursuit is pure objectivity. Particularly when it comes to doing science to investigate things you cannot see. I do that every day. And we even joke around about how when we isolate RNA or protein, we expect to see something at the bottom of the tube, and often we don't. We walk by faith and not by sight. But more seriously, there's a diverse kinds of scientists that I'm more familiar with, that are investigating things that you cannot directly observe. How deep is the ocean floor? Right? What are the mechanisms of speciation, X billion years ago? These are clearly not things that we can directly observe. And so what is it that we're doing as scientists? We are making observations and generating hypotheses, doing tests, making observations, all the classical things. But fundamentally, what we're doing is accumulating evidence in favor of one model or the other. And so when we sit down to try to uncover a particular biological phenomenon or answer a biological question, there are any number of models that might explain that, right? And our job is to, in a rigorous manner, with a careful logic, evidence that either supports or refutes one model over another. And so the reason why, for example, that the vast majority of biologists subscribe to the evolutionary theory is not because, in the purest sense of the word, anybody has gone back in history and proven it and shown the tape of history to everybody and said, well, here it is. But it is actually just the inferences that have been made over many years. In fact, when Darwin came out with his Origin of Species, there was a tremendous amount of skepticism in the scientific community. And in fact, it was actually Asa Gray, a theologian at Princeton University, who encouraged Darwin's ideas in America, and how much times have changed. Right? But over the years is the development of evidence that eventually suggested that that model that was far more plausible, enormously more plausible, than really any other model that we might invoke, right? And that's a lot of the times what we're doing in our scientific research. And so I think it is important that we are careful in thinking that science is pure objectivity and everything else is just subjective, right? We're not necessarily proving anything the way that you might in theoretical mathematics, right? It often feels like a proof because it's extremely convincing, but it's not technically a proof, right? Yeah. So I think it is important to make that point. The second thing I would mention is that, and Roald has written elegantly about this, there are other ways of knowing. That is something that I believe. For example, consider the love that my wife has for me. If any one of you challenged me to prove it, I'm not sure what I would do, because I don't really think I could. I mean, I would sit there and say, well, look, I mean, consider our life and look at what she has done for me here and there, and here's our story. But I would essentially be telling you a story, and I would be relaying a set of experiences to you, right? That would either be convincing or not, right? But I wouldn't be able to prove it. And yet, I don't know that any one of you would challenge me that I don't really know that my wife loves me, right? So there are different kinds of ways of knowing. And so even as a scientist, as I pursue reason and logic, I'm well aware the entire time that there are other ways of knowing and other ways of shaping my identity.
Even in two hard sciences like chemistry and physics, the ways of knowing are different, and the ways of knowing in chemistry, or the most interesting part of what chemistry is not reducible to physics. That's not necessarily a popular view among the physicists, and even among some chemists who are willing to accept reductionism, which is when it comes vis-a-vis biology, but then they maybe draw a line of physics. I think what Praveen has said is right. Very little of science operates in a strictly scientistic process of gathering evidence, forming hypotheses, and disproving them. A lot is stepwise accumulation of knowledge, just like he said, a kind of knowing without seeing. In the particular context of chemistry, the structures of all these molecules, we did not wait for any microscopes. There's scanning tunneling microscopy, which can show us these images. We did not wait for any microscopes to show us this, but with the hard and soft knowledge of our minds and hands combined, there have to be experiments, with our fallible senses, with the extension of our senses that instruments are, that have to be calibrated, somehow we got little pieces of indirect knowledge that there was a double bond between the carbons in this molecule, and then that we could build from that a knowledge so that we could tell whether this molecule of chlorophyll or morphine was the way that it is. And that indirect knowledge needs to be admired, and it is very important. Nevertheless, there is a scientific frame of mind, a way of looking at phenomena, which even the disparate fields of chemistry and physics and others that we share, we somehow have a feeling. It has to do with a marshaling of the evidence, the kind of questions that you ask. And nothing is proven definitely, but somehow a structure builds. Can one apply that way of thinking to questions that are questions of faith? So part of it you can. And when Praveen talks, for instance, as I've heard him talk, about the historical evidence for the existence of Christ, or the resurrection, part of it, he will marshal a quasi-scientific way of approaching that historical evidence. And the historicity question, yes, but then on other questions, I think you take a leap of faith.
Completely correct. Yes, there's only so far in certain kinds of knowing. I mean, again, going back to the love that my wife has for me. She didn't know she was going to feature so prominently in today's discussions. we're honest with ourselves. There is a little bit of, this isn't a perfect analogy, but there's a little bit of accumulation of evidence. You know, when you're dating or courting, you're looking for the signs or whether there is the evidence that this person is interested in you, that kind of thing. But at some leap of faith that this is going to work. As I said, this is not a perfect analogy, but this is in a lot of ways how my own journey and my spiritual journey was. I had an impulse even at an early age to want to be as rigorous in my investigation of things as I could. And, you know, Paul himself says that if the resurrection is not real, then Christians are to be pitied among all people because it's a royal waste of time. Everything hinges on that, right? And so if that is indeed the case, which I believe, then I darn well better do some due diligence to see whether there's feasibility here, right? And so there is, as Roald said, a quasi-scientific approach. And again, really for me, that just meant there are a lot of different models to explain what I'm sitting here reading in the Bible. Anywhere from this was real, and that's why I'm reading it, to this is legend, fabrication, you know, the greatest story ever told, and that's it, right? And then all sorts of, the possibilities in between. And so I have to look at those models and begin to look at the evidences that I can, in as much as is available to me from biblical and extra-biblical documentation, and begin to build a case for one or the other models. But at some point, one has to take a leap of faith. And reason alone is not going to bring you to the place where you say, aha, I've proven it to myself. The scientific process is necessarily agnostic with respect to God, in the sense that it can neither definitively prove or disprove his existence or any particular faith tradition.
So I do want to tell you how my undertaking a similar quasi-experimental, quasi-scientific approach led me to a lack of faith.
Yeah.
And so when I was 18, I spent the summer in Washington, D.C. I was working in National Bureau of Standards, then in downtown Washington, living in a dingy boarding house. And I decided I was going to do something rational about religion. So I went each week and to a different religious service. And one time to a Catholic church, which I knew because we had been Catholics for a year and a half. But then I went to a evangelical church where I was the only white person in town in the tabernacle, and I went to a Baha'i and Islamic service, and I looked at those, and what I saw around me, so I'm telling you of my experimental investigation, what I saw around me was people of good faith. I was welcomed in that black community. I was not made to feel any different, though I was different. And everyone was saying good things about their neighbors, about themselves. They were holding hands at the end of the service. But what I saw was these good, honest people had clearly reached rather different ideas about what religion and God meant. And I took that not as any direct evidence. I took that as part of a forming a worldview. I also had read. I had studied comparative religion in some way in a course at Columbia shortly thereafter. I took it as a worldview that there must be, so this is very different from Dawkins and Hitchens. I think religion is deeply human. It is an emergent aspect of human evolution. But it was also clear to me from this examination that whatever or whoever God or gods were, they clearly were different to different people. And so that there was no one God. To me, was my empirical conclusion to seeing the good faith diversity of religious feeling that was out there.
So we're getting to the sort of end of the structured question portion, and we're going to be taking audience questions. But I have one last question I want to ask, Roald,
yes.
You only. So, Roald, previously... You shake. Previously, you've spoken on, in fact, you've actually written on a topic that just fascinates me, and it's called the romance of discovery.
Yeah.
And the sense that there's something very thrilling and exciting and exhilarating about scientific discovery.
Yeah.
Something sort of beyond the discovery itself. A well-known atheist, Richard Dawkins, concurs with you that there could be something incredibly grand and incomprehensible and sort of beyond our understanding about science. And in fact, Cornell scientist Carl Sagan said the following: science is not only compatible with spirituality, it's a profound source of spirituality. Some take this as to be a signal that maybe there is a belief in a transcendence in your life, in their lives, and I'd like you to comment on that. Do you agree or disagree with Carl Sagan?
In general, I agree with Carl Sagan. He also said a number of other things about science being a beacon in a world full of darkness in other ways. I just put a different spin or angle on what you say. I think there is something emerging out of the human condition, as many other, let us not speak of the evil things, but as many of the other good things, music, language, ethics, these are human creations, I would say. I think religion is one of them. There is something, there is a natural emergent quality, and I could talk some more on what emergence means in science or other outside of science, but it is an emergent quality that when you put diverse human beings together, that they will seek, aside from the selfish satisfaction that they have in gaining specific knowledge that I do in the science, I publish it. And part of it is that part of the professionalism of science that I publish it. But part of it is I do want to share it. There is something that I do share with other people. And when I go outside at night, we are near a full moon, and I look at that moon, and if I'm lucky enough to see stars, yes, I have personal pleasure in doing so, but part of that pleasure is that I'm sharing it with other people who are looking at the same objects, and I think we are sharing a spiritual feeling. I think the closest, probably, that we come to a shared transcendence or religious experience in our world is probably in listening to music. The most abstract of art forms, and yet capable of making you cry. And is there anything better in the world than dancing with friends?
I think I need to let Praveen answer that one.
Well, that was a wonderful way to end, Roald, because I feel, you know, there are a lot more similarities in the way that we think than there are dissimilarities, actually. And I, too, am quite fond of music, and perhaps even more so, because, in fact, I think it's what makes me tick. I meet with God in moments when I am listening to music. And believe it or not, it can be human nature, Michael Jackson, as much as it could be, you know, Eric Clue and some sort of smooth jazz. So, you know, music is a very transcendent experience for us. With regard to Carl Sagan's quote, I sort of, whether I agree or disagree, I think to some extent depends on what spiritual means. I think we all use it in very different ways. Based on the context of that quote, I think what Carl was going after, in my best estimation, is the awe and the wonder that we feel as scientists in the scientific enterprise, but really as any of us, as we're interacting with the world around us. I think that there is a remarkable beauty that most of us are extremely inspired by and impressed by. And if that's what Carl means by spirituality, then, you know, I completely agree with that sentiment. In some ways, though, I think that the scientific enterprise has been spiritual for me, not only in what it has shown me, but what I have come to understand it can't show me. And, you know, Darwinian evolution has done a beautiful job of helping us to understand any number of traits that humans or a number of other organisms may have. It has even done so far a good job in explaining our various behaviors that may be hard to quantify and nail down. But why it is that we have emotional correlates for those things and that we have subjective experiences, and importantly, why is it that we are even here having this discussion, striving to determine whether there is any meaning in life? These are things that do make us uniquely human, and these are things that, as of yet anyway, are not well addressed. Even the most strident of atheists or people that are non-believers generally concede that while that doesn't, of course, necessarily point to the existence of God, it is something that science is not addressing. And that is something that we are uniquely human in. There are a lot of emotional traits that we share with animals and other organisms, but that we have these the consciousness and subjective experiences that help shape our identity and lead us to question why there is anything at all and why there is meaning, that is something that I think makes us uniquely human and is a spiritual experience.
Right, so I think we're going to move to audience questions now. Can someone bring the questions up to me? There we go. Thank you. Modern technology, you've got to love it, right? Thank you so much. So I see we don't have the people who asked the question actually identified, so you are anonymous. So the first question is for Praveen. Do you think that the world has only one God, and do you all religions claim the same goals but are different, but by different means?
So, you know, I do think that there's remarkable sharing of ideas across a lot of different faith traditions. If you boil down the religious experience to a set of ideas and concepts that help us to live our lives better, there's remarkable concordance. And we can quibble about some of the differences. And some of those differences are, I think, rather interesting to discuss, and we don't have time to today. But it must be stated that there's remarkable concordance with a lot of these ideas. The golden rule that everybody likes to talk about is not a uniquely Christian concept, right? I mean, this is present in a lot of different faith traditions. And so I don't subscribe to the idea that there is nothing that other faith traditions can offer, that there is no truth that is held within them. That being said, to me, it's really not fundamentally, and I think maybe this is because a little bit of my background, a sort of pitting of one against the other. To me, it's fundamentally about the person of Christ. And in fact, you know, if you take Hinduism, I was recently talking to a Hindu scholar who said, look, you say you're Christian, that's fine, you're Hindu, right? So, there are diverse opinions of what it even means to believe in Hinduism and to be a Hindu. And so it's a bit difficult, actually, to nail down and say, you know, I'm going to compare these two things. I think for me the most critical thing is the person of Christ. He has been transformative in my life, and it's through the process of developing a relationship with someone that I think is actually real that I have grown to understand what the Christian faith is to me. And so I think there's a separation of culture and cultural values and cultural ideals from all sorts of different traditions that I highly value and incorporate in my own life. But the most critical thing to me is trying to understand who the person of Jesus is in my life and how that influences who I am. And to a large extent, going back to this idea of the very radical self-sacrifice that he made on behalf of mankind, and then calls us to make. And I think that is unique, and I think that it is very critical to understand that as we process our human identity.
Thank you, Praveen. The next question is for you, Roald. The Holocaust is the dominant challenge to many Jews' faith, but without God, where do we find comfort, and where do you find comfort in particular?
So, those of you who know me know that I'm an optimist about human nature. I don't lock my car. I mean, it's a trivial thing. But, so, what is that? Is that a faith in Ithaca? Is that a faith? It is. But basically, I don't know where it comes from, but I think part of it is survival of that same Holocaust and being grateful for that survival. And in that played a part of the goodness of some people who hit us out in the last 15 months of the war. So there was an act of goodness. Also, I was in the midst of great evil, but I was in what I've called a cocoon of love, of an immediate family. I have a basic optimism about human nature. It occasionally struggles when I get the referee's reports on my paper. There's this bunch of people who were born without logic. I'm basically...
I'm thankful that a Nobel laureate is struggling with that.
Right,
it's not just
me. Just got a set. I find that optimism just in the scattered acts of goodness by human beings. Mm. In the midst of a lot of bad things, you only have to listen to the television or look on a newspaper. And yet there is enough there to go on for me. It comes just from interaction with humanity.
Right. So here's a provocative question. I think either of you can take, or both of you can take it. Listening to the speakers, it seems that religion itself is a reflection of who we are who you are and your identity. It then implies that truth in religion depends on who you are. What is the universal truth then, and how do we find it? Maybe you can start.
Sure. I think in some extent this is true, although by no means do I think that we have proven this, but that doesn't mean that we won't in the future, or at least, as we've been referencing before, provide an accumulation of evidence in favor of the idea that the emergence of religion is a purely evolutionary reality. Some people even subscribe to the notion that it is an evolutionary misfiring, something that occurred across the course of evolution, has led to us to come up with religion, and is an unfortunate consequence of whatever the evolutionary process was. I'll let Rod speak to that. I don't believe he holds that position. That's the position of someone like maybe a Richard Dawkins has said that, for example. But I think there's a lot more to be done in that arena. These are speculations, by and large, very controversial. Some people have models to talk about this. That kind of research is very much in its infancy, in my opinion. Again, we should be careful to say because it will never be able to demonstrate some of the claims. So I think the more important question is, let's say it is able to demonstrate those claims, that it's a pure biological phenomena, the emergence of religion. That's not particularly damning for me in terms of the existence of God and the reality of Christ and these kinds of things, because who am I to say God has brought about any number of things that make us human through the evolution process, that he would also make us to some extent spiritually capable and desirous of knowing something beyond ourselves in part through an evolutionary process is, I think, perfectly compatible with everything else that I've seen him do. And so the idea that religion as a notion, as a concept, that there's something beyond us, that we're looking for something else, that it could evolve, is not problematic for me. And I don't think that it necessarily, I think it in a lot of ways sets the stage. It sets the stage for him to introduce himself in a context and to a species that is ready to hear. So that's one way to think about it.
So I would say that all that there is what is, and that suffices for me. But let me expand a little bit on that. What I mean is, if you think that you are in a culturally diverse group of people and you are Christians, most of you, and you are, and I ask you to look at another group of people somewhere sitting in a university in Japan or in India. Maybe there is less diversity because they don't have the economic wealth to bring immigrants there that we have, but the diversity with respect to goodness or evil, with respect to morality, among those people grown up in an entirely different tradition and devoid of your idea of religion, I think the diversity is there and it is equally heartening, and it makes me think that the possibility is there in all human beings, independent of what religious beliefs they have.
So, Raul, the next question and the second to last question is for you. Are there objective moral standards? And if so, whence do they come?
So I think moral standards, I'm not going to give a lecture on where ethics comes from. There are different views of ethics. One of them only is, for instance, a deontological one, that there are, let's say, typically typified by religion giving you a set of moral ethical guidelines. There is also a calculus of utility, the least harm done to least people. That's what the government actually uses in a number of drug tests. And finally, there is a virtue kind of way of looking. That is, you model your behavior on, I'm just saying it one way, you model your behavior on those of other people whose behavior you admire. I think part of moral standards are including altruism as an important component, come out biologically, though I don't share entirely Wilson's social determinism in biology. I think a lot is structured by human beings forced to interact with other human beings in confined circumstances. The paradise where we live far away from each other, didn't have to meet other people. It never existed because we always had family structures even then. But we are now forced to interact with each other, and therefore we are forced to enter a social contract. And as part of that social contract, there are moral obligations. So we abrogate the right to do some things in exchange for other privileges. I think ethics arises out of natural, personal, and societal interactions.
Praveen, I feel I must give you the opportunity to answer that same question, so let me just repeat it. And that is, are there objective moral standards, and if so, from whence do they come?
I think it would be fairly straightforward. You may expect my response that there are objective moral standards. I should caveat that, though, by saying that we have imposed moral standards in a number of areas as religious people throughout history and even now, in areas that I think are inappropriate. And, I think that must be said. That's been happening since, the beginning of humanity. And that's, I think, a tendency to impose our own will rather than a true objective standard on others. But I do believe, because I believe that there is a God, and that he is a God of order and not a God of disorder, that there are objective moral standards and that they do come from him. Many of these objective moral standards, as I mentioned earlier, are shared among many different people groups. And I think that this is not surprising given the reality that we are all made in the image of God and that we are all children of God and have his fingerprints on us. And so under the auspices of that framework, it isn't surprising that you would see many of these objective standards shared across traditions. You might bring up the point that there are some cultures that you can point to where the moral standards are completely flipped. Right, so how do we deal with that? Where did they get their standards from? Right, and so I don't know that it is so much about the standards as much as it is our striving for there to be standards in the first place. I think that's perhaps more of the key question as to, and I don't know that the answers from the evolutionary community are fully satisfying. There is a lot of controversy on how their altruism and kin selection and things like this may have come about. There are some useful and interesting models, but I think there's a lot more to be done there. But perhaps what I'll leave you with is this. Even if there are evolutionary models to explain it and things like that, and increasingly that's, we're finding more and more that there are naturalistic explanations for any number of things, it doesn't preclude, immediately the question becomes, is there a need for God? And I have never quite understood that question, because either he exists or not. I'm not saying he exists because I find a need for him necessarily. I'm saying that I think first of all, science, properly constrained within its purview, doesn't demand that there can't be a God. And secondly, in the best of my estimation, that's the model that makes the most sense. But because there are naturalistic explanations for things does not preclude that there is a God. That may very well be how he chose to bring things about. And so that's a distinction that I think should be made as well.
Mm-hmm. So this clock in front of me is telling me that our time is nearly up, but I would like to ask both of you to maybe make some concluding remarks along these lines. As we've concluded the portion of discussion, move on to these concluding remarks, what I'd like you to maybe address with the students in the audience is helping them deal with how they are deal with their identity and faith, and maybe particularly within an academic environment where it can be fairly aggressive in terms of discussions of faith and identity. So how do they find their faith? What guidelines would you give them to do that and their identity? Maybe, Walt, if you could start on the literary and finish.
As I said before, part of it is in your genes. But that's in some ways the least part. And this is why knowledge of the genome and all those diseases, what does one do with that knowledge? It's an interesting ethical problem of our times. If you find out you have a 2% greater disposition toward a certain type of tumor. There is something in our genes that guides us. So much more comes from the environment. And I want to say to the students that you are in the midst of the greatest mind-shaping interval in your lives, in your college education. For me, the world opened up at Columbia in a core curriculum, in a poetry course, in a history of art course. Everything in my subsequent life was shaped by the intellectual environment and your peers as well. And your ethical makeup was surely already shaped by the time you have reached your stage. But it's an intellectual adventure. So what I'm telling you is, don't look at those distribution requirements as a requirement. They're an opportunity for you to learn things that you never imagined you could learn before. And then you are an individual. It is true there are all these influences, but what will shape you both as a person with who makes a living, as eventually a husband or wife, a father and mother, what will shape your moral situation is in your hands. It's available in the novels that you read. Even in the prayer services that you go to, in the sharing that you do with other people. For God's sake, don't avoid interaction with other human beings, not on the web. See, that's a double negative. But I think you know what I mean. And you will be shaped in ways that you cannot imagine. You will emerge as an individual human being, the same as other people and yet different.
One of the goals of these kinds of events, at least as far as I'm concerned and as I understand the mission of Veritas, is that we can demonstrate what it looks like to have a mutual conversation among two people that on a particular topic happen to disagree. We are not doing this well nationally. And we are exporting this problem elsewhere because of the influence that we have on the global sphere. This is my primary concern, that we are not having this conversation in a reflective manner, in a thoughtful manner, and in a humble manner. I happen to disagree with Rowald on some of the things we discussed today. I have great respect and admiration for Rowald and the processes that he went through to end up where he is now. And amazingly, he has the same respect for me. And I think that we need to start from that place of humility. Rich Mullins, who is one of my heroes, said that, and this is for some of the Christians in the audience, if we were given the Bible, it was not so that we could thump our chest and say we are right. It's so that we could recognize that we know very little. And that as a Christian, you believe God is right. And if we assume that posture in the conversations that we have, a posture of humility, a posture of, you know, I don't know the answers to a lot of things. I'm on the journey myself. I want to wrestle with these things with you. I want to talk to people who disagree with me. I want to be willing to be challenged. I want to be willing to listen to why their experiences have shaped them. I'm going to think about the things that Rowald has said today, right? And that's the way that it should be. And I really want to encourage each of you in the audience to take that posture. You guys are going to be the leaders of the future. And if you can set the tone for how to have this conversation, then maybe we can begin to see change nationally and internationally. The second thing, and I've made this point a few times, but it's really what I want to leave you with. Neither Rowald and I are here to convince you of either one of our positions. We've made it clear that there's an element of faith to both of our positions. It's what we have felt ultimately most comfortable with. And a lot of where we agree, actually, is what the purview of science is and isn't. And science has really achieved this status in our culture among lay people that it has a certain kind of authority that, I don't know, in maybe times past doctors had, you know, or things like that. That science can answer everything for us, the burning questions of life. And I think as a scientist, I have a responsibility and a burning desire to respect and honor what science is and what it isn't. And I would challenge you to do the same. Think critically and carefully about what these various frameworks that we interact with in life, what they can and cannot answer for us. Because I think one of the most principal things for me in my life was realizing not that science proved or disproved anything to me in the spiritual realm, but only that I was freed from the conception or the misconception that science categorically disproves the things that are supernatural. Being freed from that, I was able to do my own reflective study. And you might come out on any number of sides when you do your own reflection on that. But I want you to feel the freedom to do that reflection about the supernatural.
Curious, be energetic, look at it, yes, examine. So I know that Alicia's going to come up and give us thanks. And what I do, I just want to personally thank both the speakers tonight. It's been a really stimulating and interesting discussion. Return again.
Thanks, Rosemary. Yeah.